Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
In this Big Ideas, I'm talking with three contributors to the Griffith Review's Hey Utopia edition about some unexpected realities and revelations amid the pandemic and how they shape our vision for other ways the world could be. What lessons have we learnt about who and what is valued, and why were certain decisions taken and others not? I'm speaking with Julian Meyrick, Professor of Creative Arts at Griffith University. David Threlfall, academic and writer from Melbourne, who's writing a PhD at the London School of Economics and Political Science. And Kristen Rundle, a professor of law at the University of Melbourne. This discussion was recorded in Melbourne when Victoria was in the final stage of lockdown. The speakers are reflecting on what we and they have been through. I began by asking David Threlfall whether we'd had the important conversations we need to have about the pandemic and the road ahead.
I don't want to start immediately with a negative answer to the question. I think, yes, we are having them, but we're having those kind of questions really partially. A lot of the conversation is simply about the path out of lockdown and the numbers we need to hit to get out of lockdown. And 70 and 80 are important milestones to get to, but they hide a deeper conversation that I think you're hinting at and that many are hinting at, but that we don't quite achieve on a public scale. So I think there's a distinction here between narrow or small conversations between a few people, perhaps between experts of the functioning of the hospital system, how many ambulances are needed to function at this level of sickness, but we're not tying those threads together. And where that comes back to my personal situation, I know you said we'll come to the story itself in a while, but in the months since writing that story, my circumstances have changed. We're out of the hospital now, thankfully. And yet I'm still deeply worried about Charlotte, my daughter's health. She's recovering from chronic lung disease of prematurity. And so as I hear talk about these numbers and I think about what that means for us, I want to have a really open conversation about how opening at 60, 70, 80% might impact on people with liver and lung transplants or people with disability or people who have acute anxieties about opening up after such a long time here in Melbourne and also elsewhere in lockdown. And there are difficult but possible answers to those ethical questions. And I don't think we're quite having those yet. Instead, the numbers are leading the conversation. And more often than not, economic questions are leading the conversation. And that can be quite frustrating if you feel that you're on the outer fringe of that kind of decision making.
What do you think about that, Julian? Have the types of questions that David was talking about there been kind of pushed aside while we talk about numbers and timetables and technical responses and so on, even if it's kind of necessary for us to have that conversation?
That's a really interesting question, Paul. I was just thinking that if you think about the duration of the pandemic and the things that have happened in it, then one key question for us as individuals, but also as a society, is when does a problem cease to be a short-term shock? And when does it become a sort of long-term issue that has to be addressed in some other way? And I think I feel that in some way, a bit like a soccer match, the pandemic has been a sort of game of two halves, but we haven't quite clocked that we're in the second half. We're still playing the game from the first half, in which it can still be explained away. It can still be kind of boxed and framed in a certain way. And I think the numbers have a sort of comforting function. You know, if you put numbers and you say, well, this is what the loss is, never mind that from an economic perspective, it's meaningless. But nevertheless, the numbers give you a sense that, you know, things are proportional, they're comparative, you can control them. When something becomes a kind of long-term issue, of course, the consequences of it become much more complicated. And they also become incommensurate in the sense that how do you balance people's need to go to a job with their mental health? I mean, there's no scale that will do that. you know, you have to sit down and you have to kind of work it through in terms of a collective conversation. And I think I'm with David in the sense that I do not see that conversation having progressed very much at this stage. Although my heart tells me that I can understand why, that you know, from a human point of view, it's actually very confronting to kind of go, no, this problem isn't going to go away.
Kristen, you're hoping, I gather from your essay, that the pandemic and our response to it gives us pause to reflect more on the responsibilities of government and ministers and what happens when we outsource essential services like security services at quarantine hotels. You write about that specifically, but do you think more generally, are we having a discussion about how we're governed during a time of COVID?
I don't think we are, and we can come back to my thoughts perhaps later on the moment that the hotel quarantine inquiry represented in terms of opportunity to have a much wider conversation about how we're governed in at the level of techniques and generally. But I want to pick up on something that both Julian and David just said about the threads of conversations we're having around these complex ethical issues that we're living. From a lawyer's point of view, a public lawyer's point of view, we were fortunate in Australia in the sense that we already had legislation in place that gave the relevant emergency powers that have been the way through which being governed throughout this pandemic. Like, we didn't have to create powers for the circumstances. So there's something very dignified about that, right? But to pick up Julian's point, when does an emergency go on for so long that it becomes something else? And I don't think any of the regimes that we're being governed under right now were ever made in a way that envisaged that 18 months in, we would still be living in what is ultimately an executive branched government where we've got little democratic deliberation going on around these issues. So there's something about the way this emergency has become long and stretched that has also necessitated us thinking about, well, when do we start to democratize it a bit more? At what point do we have more community conversations about the dilemmas we're in and the uncomfortable realities, we're all frightening realities that we're all heading into? This can't just take place through us waiting to find out today's numbers and today's decisions. It's actually a much broader set of questions that need a much wider conversational framework to be properly discussed. So as David said, there's threads of conversations, there are little hints out there that come to us, but we don't even have the governmental arrangements in place right now to fully take them by the horns and to look at them in all of their possibility and their ugliness and the rest.
Well, let's talk about one phrase that we're hearing a lot of at the moment, David. Living with COVID. We're all being told that we're moving from the phase that we were in into this new phase, living with COVID. Generally speaking, once we hit the 80% double vaccination level is when we do that. Now, living with COVID means, among other things, accepting a death toll, maybe accepting a large death toll, and accepting that there will be a certain group of people who are more likely to die. How do we define acceptable deaths? How many deaths are acceptable and unacceptable? Why is there so little conversation about this?
I think because politically it's a really fraught question to front up to how many people you're going to allow to die and who those people might be. In the UK, to put a statistic on this, at the end of 2020, the Office for National Statistics said that 60% of those who died from COVID in 2020 were disabled, were living with a disability. And that is just an extremely shocking statistic. It was 30,000 people out of 50,000 at that point in time. The death toll is now over 135,000. And I imagine that statistic holds with more than double the amount of people who've since passed away. And that's just frankly shocking. In the Australian context, I read similarly on deaths of those with disability that one disability advocate sees much pandemic policy as tantamount to a purge of those with disability. And that's just, it's a scary word, but if the reality of those who will be more likely to pass away from the disease once we decide to live with it, it's hard not to step away from those existential thoughts and to see that your community, if that happens to be your community, is targeted more than others. And so I think we avoid these conversations. I'm speaking on behalf of those in power, avoid those conversations because it's incredibly difficult to say we are willing to open up society and to condemn you either to indefinite lockdown or to a really potentially awful future. And that really troubles me. I don't want to spend too much time on the statistics, but when we're talking about the impact of lockdowns and the physical health measures to stop the pandemic and the virus spreading, we hear about the mental health cost of lockdown and the economic costs of remaining in lockdown as well. But the costs of each individual death aren't talked about. And so I was reading the other week a paper out of the US about a bereavement multiplier, which is a very odd sounding term, but the idea is that every death touches 9 people closely. And so if in the US you have almost 700,000 people who are dead, and each of those has impacted 9 people directly, we're into the many millions of people affected, and the mental health impact of that that death and the grief it causes for a long time afterwards is shocking. And so this is such a complicated conversation to have, but it's simpler to stay close to the numbers and to say that you're acting based on the evidence provided to you by the epidemiologists, and this is all that you can do in this situation, when in fact there are other public health measures aside from lockdowns that you could put into place at the same time to mitigate, or you could talk to those communities affected to see what they need done to make them feel safer about coming out of lockdown.
Yeah, there's a narrowing of the conversation in the same way, Julian, as there was a narrowing of the response to it as well. I mean, throughout the COVID period, the government, for example, has propped up the economy by injecting billions of dollars, including, we now know, into businesses that didn't need the money and that actually didn't even qualify for it, but we'll put that aside. But then, of course, choosing to ignore or virtually ignore some sectors altogether. Universities didn't qualify for JobKeeper, and the arts sector, devastated by COVID, was, if not ignored, certainly done no favours by the government. Why were the arts overlooked as drastically as they were?
I want to say a little bit sort of similarly to David. I don't think that the lack of an inclusive and ethically informed conversation has just suddenly happened over the last 18 months because of COVID. I think it's part of a long-term trend. And I think for the artists that I've spoken to over the last 18 months, and it's been a wide variety of them, the lack of financial support has obviously not been great, but the rhetorical shock of being excluded from the policy process has been extremely confronting. And so if the pandemic is, as I suspect most people think of it, is as a sort of national catastrophe, one kind or another, then that would presage a moment for the most kind of inclusive conversation possible. And I don't think that arts and culture are especially more important than anything, but they're certainly not less important, nor are the artists in it somehow, you know, not worthy of the same attention that the people who build buildings. So there still is no answer to that question. Even 18 months onwards, it's a bit like Kristen writing about the quarantine investigation inquiry last year, that you know, went in to illuminate something and came out with questions, even more questions than it started with. Arts and culture in Australia are part of who Australia is. Lots of people work in them. The numbers just, you know, they're endless. And yet they were just simply left out.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it also raised the question of like, well, what else is being left out? And then once you flip that question, you then kind of go, well, actually, what's being included? And then you start to get a kind of cold feeling in your heart because you think actually only a small number of things actually count here. And that's a very disturbing thought to have about the country that you're living in.
Yeah, I feel, Kristen, like we've all needed the arts in the past 20 months or so. It's not just that artists have been denied an income or in some cases even their ability to practice their art, which is bad enough. There's also this assumption that the arts are not fundamental to our ability as a community to get through this, when I think they so clearly are. You know, since I've moved back to Melbourne, there have been only kind of rare opportunities that I've had to go and see music being performed, which is my thing, which is the thing I like to do. But yet this is so disregarded, the role of the arts. And any thoughts on that? I know you're a public lawyer.
I'm also a passionate arts lover and a music background as well, Paul. I think that the thread I'm seeing across the comments that all three of you have just made is about this failure to confront or engage with the human implications of what we are doing, and that there is no way around those through numbers and so forth. That if we think about the techniques through which we're making these decisions, are they fully comprehending those human implications? Because so many of the scenarios that we've seen unfold during this pandemic, think about what went on with the aged care sector, for example. None of this is accidental. It's like you were saying, Julian, about the arts. This is a moment in which we get to find out where we were already at with respect to how particular sectors of human activity are being handled, supported, marginalised, and so forth.
Professor Kristen Rundle from the University of Melbourne Law School. I'm also speaking with Julian Meyrick, Professor of Creative Arts at Griffith University, and academic and writer David Threlfall. Back to Kristen Rundle, talking about last year's COVID-19 hotel quarantine inquiry in Victoria.
I think actually, as bizarre as this might sound, Paul, one of the things that was so extraordinary about following that hotel quarantine inquiry last year was that it was actually theatre at some particular level. There were extraordinarily interesting players that were on the stage. Each day you got some insight into a particular sector of Australian society, people who run hotels, people who are in the security industry, people who are in politics and so forth. And we were watching a drama unfold in live stream. So it was actually, we're watching it in a way that was almost like engaging with creative work and watching this unfold. And it really did feel to me like I was waiting for something that was on stage in Act 1 to resolve itself in Act 3, because it was so interesting the way that the narrative wove through in often a dramatic way, but leaving more questions than it answered. So bizarrely, I found that quite a nourishing experience following that inquiry closely, because it was a human drama and it was being enacted by the human players who actually make the decisions around how we live. And we were getting an opportunity to have that in focus in a way that can't be concluded in, for example, a single interview with a journalist or so forth. It went on and it went on for hours and days and weeks. And so there was an element of witnessing that was possible that I think is something that we all seek from the arts as well, is to be able to watch, to listen, to witness, to be held still as we contemplate where we're at.
I mean, it really is, even from the vantage point now of looking back on that moment, an utterly astonishing moment. So we have this existential pandemic that hits Australia, we close our international borders, we limit international flights, and our last line of protection is quarantine. We choose to quarantine people coming back into the country from overseas in hotels. Okay, we now know that was a problem because of airborne transmission and so on. We didn't know that back then. And then, you know, this is a national emergency, and then what do? We say, are we going to hand over the responsibility to secure those establishments to private security firms? A big decision, and it causes a crisis. It causes the big wave of COVID transmission that gets into the nursing homes, that kills hundreds of people. And then we have an inquiry to figure out what the hell went wrong, and we can't even determine how or who the decision was made by. I mean, it is astonishing, isn't it?
It is astonishing, and yet it isn't. And that's what's so alarming. The astonishing part is that one would assume a question like, who made a decision to do a particular consequential action would be easily answered. And the reason why is because our whole system of accountability relies on the idea that questions like that can be answered. That's how you find out who is the person who stands up and says, I'm responsible, I'll either do the following things by way of remediation, I'll resign, whatever that might be. But then at the other level, what was so pedestrian about the astonishing factor about it all was the fact that once it became evident that there wasn't a who and there wasn't a decision, that there basically this decision had just happened because it was evidently the way government does its work, no one had thought twice about that. No one had thought about whether there was any considerations of appropriateness with such a novel function that no one had done before, that once that became apparent, we didn't then ask more questions about what did we just learn then. And that's what I found was the lost opportunity, was that once it became apparent on the evidence that the question that was obvious to ask was not going to be answered, we needed to change the conversation. And we didn't quite take that because the public, which was itself fascinating, and the media as well, was so bent on answering this unanswerable question and outraged, rightly so, that it could not be answered. But they stayed, there was a desire to kind of stay in the tangle that something must be being evaded here. Someone's not telling the truth. Something's going on in terms of individuals that are hiding things, when what really was happening is we were getting a glimpse of how things work, and that's the problem.
No one was asking the question, how did we get to this point where it was considered the normal functioning of government that in a moment like this, at a time like this, it is just utterly reasonable that a government might make a decision to outsource a responsibility like that, and in doing so, make it more difficult for ministers and governments to be held accountable and responsible for that decision.
That's right. So what was so intriguing about this moment, I mean, I follow quite a few inquiries where contracting out is an element of it, and it's very, very rare that it stays in focus the whole way through. So this was extraordinary. People were paying attention to the way government does its work, and people seemed to have a very strong view that they did not like that. But what we learned is that emergencies tell you about your starting assumptions, and that we basically froze the screen on a moment where we found out that this was the normal way of doing things, so normal indeed that there were basically no other options. And I think this is a very important part of the picture. When I was doing some media on this last year, I would be talking about how there needed to be far more principled consideration about when these things were appropriate and when they're not. And I would sometimes have people email me and say, but Kristen, what you don't understand is we don't have the public sector capability these days to do this kind of work. And of course, I do understand that. I'm just refusing to engage with it. Like I'm refusing to say that the way forward has to start with the current assumptions and current parameters. That's precisely what needs to shift. If the public has a view on the significance of how government actually performs the functions we've entrusted to it, then let us have that view and let there be choices between alternatives available to us. Something has to shift in that regard.
Mm, yeah. So, David, what did you make of it? I mean, you're someone who has a background in politics and government as well. What did you make of that whole decision-making process and the subsequent inquiry into it? Did it amount to an abrogation of government responsibility?
Yes, absolutely. On the face of it, it did. But much as Kristen has said, I think I was unsurprised by the fact that this was the path that was taken, as it's a common way of government operating these days, and that the capacity question is perhaps one explanation. But I think the accountability explanation is more interesting and more generative for our thinking from here on out. And if the reason we've arrived at this situation isn't the capacity, it's on some level that there was also a decision made that this would be a good way to make those in power less accountable, then that is such an important conversation to have. And this is becoming a strong theme across our conversation today. The fact that these conversations aren't happening, despite the fact that we've been gifted this incredible pause in almost everything in the world by the pandemic, it's it's really in hindsight quite shocking that we've got time on our hands, even if it feels a little as though time is flowing a bit differently because we've got nothing to mark it with. But if we're not going to have these conversations now, when the problems are staring us in the face and the consequences are quite literally life and death, then when, if ever, will we have these conversations?
Yeah, you were in the UK when the pandemic hit there, as you described, has had a devastating impact on the UK. Coming back to Australia, did you feel that it was a place where you were able to take a kind of safe harbour before, you know, before your big personal drama unfolded?
Oh, absolutely. It was actually quite shocking, the contrast between the UK and Australia. It feels like a period of sliding doors moments. So we flew out of the UK on the 22nd of March, landed in Australia on the 23rd last year. And we had a chat, my partner Elizabeth and I, about a week before we flew, where we did a pros and cons list of whether we should leave or not, or if we should hole up in England. And we had a weekend where Elizabeth did a lot of cooking. I had all of my assessment due at the university about a week later. So she went and did a big shop, did all the cooking. We thought we were going to wait it out. And then 2 days later, the university closed. They gave their undergrads 2 days to be out and to take everything with them. They gave their postgrads 5 days to be out and to take everything with them. They said, we are going to take no responsibility for your health whatsoever. That pressed us into a kind of rushed decision, and we bought a flight that cost about four times as much as it cost to get over to England, but it costs four times more to get back now. So in hindsight, it was quite cheap. But in amongst all of that rush in England still, although the university had closed, nothing had changed. The streets were still quite busy. We got to the airport and the English-looking people, it's a dangerous way to put it, but people who look like they weren't too far from home were confused at all the people in masks looking panicked. And we were in that category. We had masks on from Elizabeth's lab and we were ready to have a very scared flight back home. And once we got home and we got into the house where we were quarantining, we could breathe a sigh of relief, take the masks off and relax. And then life was really quite normal for 3 or 4 months until Melbourne's first lockdown began, the longer lockdown. And so, yes, Australia provided a safe harbour, and it also seemed to be a country where the pandemic was being taken much more seriously. The contrast between the university's response and then the national response in the UK was quite shocking at the time, and it was a relief to be back here, definitely.
Look, I know I'm moving all over the place, but let's just stick with the situation that you found yourself in before I come back to Julian. You have written about really a kind of genuine personal nightmare, really. You know, the rest of us were grappling with COVID. You were grappling with COVID and a newborn daughter delivered via an emergency C-section who had arrived seriously premature, and your partner who'd given birth to her also in a very, very bad state. There was a moment, you write terrifyingly, where dreams of a potential life with three of us came within days of there being just one of us, bereft and lonely. How do you feel about just taking us back to those days and just talking us through what happened? Because it's a terrifying vision.
Yeah, it is, and it was terrifying at the time, absolutely. So for the month leading up to those 2 days, two rapid fire days in the hospital, Elizabeth had been going into the hospital for more frequent scans. Her week 20 scan, everything seemed to be going okay, but then we asked for the report from the sonographer to be able to talk about it with our GP, and there was just a little kind of a footnote at the bottom of this one-page report that said perhaps consider a follow-up scan in 4 weeks because of the bone length. So there was something measuring a little bit small. And we talked to our GP and actually went in for a scan 2 weeks later, and then again 2 weeks later, and things were getting increasingly complicated, but not any clearer. And the second time around, we were in at the hospital for the scan, and we almost were sent home. We got to the end of the day. The scan had happened. Elizabeth had had an amniocentesis as well. We were trying to get the clearest picture. After this follow-up scan at 24 weeks, a doctor in the corridor who wasn't the doctor treating Elizabeth just looked askance at her and said, "You don't look well," took her blood pressure, and the pace of everything changed immediately. She was immediately administered with a steroid that promotes the growth of the lungs in the unborn baby, because the lungs are the last organ to develop in the womb. And if she was going to deliver at short notice, the baby needed the best chance of being able to survive. And so those steroids would offer that opportunity. She then needed to have 48 hours for the steroids to have the best effect. They're delivered at 0 hours and then at 24 hours. And we just made it to 24 hours, but around one day after that first dose, everything sped up again. The monitoring was becoming increasingly worrying. And so we went straight into the theatre, and Charlotte, as she happened to be, we didn't know her sex before then, was delivered late on Saturday night after the worst Saturday of my life. I know people talk about their child's birth as the best, and Charlotte is an amazing young girl now, a little over 9 months old, although 6 months from her original due date. And so to us, she's a little 6 month old. But that was just a horrific day and an incredibly scary day, as Elizabeth was so unwell and Charlotte too was so unwell. Thinking about that day, actually, I was transported back to it this week. I had to photocopy her discharge papers for one of her practitioners at the moment, and I was reading through them, and there was something I didn't understand, a rating for her at 1 minute of life, 5 minutes of life, and 10 minutes of life. And the rating got increasingly higher at 1, 5, and 10 minutes. And so I looked up online what this medical rating meant. And it means that at 1 minute, her rating was only 1 out of a possible 10, 5 categories that add up to 2. And so I don't know what the split is for that 1 point out of 5 categories, but it means she was either not breathing, her heart wasn't beating, or most likely both at that point in time. And yet, here we are so many months later, and she was effectively dead at birth, and that's why she disappeared from the theatre so quickly. And now she was giggling just before the interview. You know, we were playing peekaboo with her and reading books. It's just quite shocking to think. And that was just the start of 5 months in the hospital. That was just the first moments of her life. And the conclusion to a scary few weeks of uncertainty was that she was going to be born 15 weeks early. We were completely amazed at all of the nurses and doctors and the work that they do. It's such a stressful environment. It's a really traumatic environment. You're working in literally life and death scenarios day to day, and then you have moments that are completely different to that, where you're talking with people and you're having to be light and happy, and the breadth of work is incredible. But the environment is punishing, the work is punishing, and so to turn up every day and provide that service is amazing. And so it makes me quite sad thinking back on our experience, but then connecting that to now with the pandemic, to read the news about healthcare workers in Melbourne who've been advised not to wear their scrubs to work, to not come in uniform because they might be abused on the way in. In the US, it's at another level, where people are being physically assaulted. Nurses and doctors' badges have been turned into panic buttons in some hospitals. That to me, during a pandemic, when these are the people who are keeping us healthy and well and hoping to end the pandemic, it's not as if those working in the medical sector would like the pandemic to go longer. They're being traumatized by the treatment that they're having to administer as well. COVID wards are incredibly, incredibly difficult. And it's shocking to think about the treatment of our medical workers. I guess to sort of wrap that up, I've been thinking often about COVID wards and what they might look like. And I think on some level, Elizabeth and I have a really good idea. One day, our lead doctor who was there with Charlotte the whole way along, she was an amazing practitioner. She said one morning in the rounds, we had to be in by 8 a.m. each morning on only a few hours sleep. We'd leave in the late evening around midnight and come back in the early morning to be with Charlotte. But her doctor said on the morning rounds, perhaps they should give us control of all the COVID patients. We've been doing complicated ventilation of patients all of our lives. That's what we do in the NICU, because the lungs, as I said earlier, are the last organ to grow and to mature. And so ventilation is their bread and butter. Keeping these tiny little premature babies alive is really complex respiratory work. And so when I read about patient to staff ratios changing in New South Wales, for example, it's just such a scary thought to think that Charlotte in her time of need wouldn't have had a nurse one-on-one. That's incredible resourcing, but it kept her alive. And so there are all of these moments where we can do little things to make it easier for the nurses and doctors who are looking after us. Mm. And to know that people aren't doing everything to look after them is a point of great sadness after what we've been through.
I'm in discussion with Professor Kristen Rundle, David Threlfall, and Professor Julian Mayrick. Yeah, Julian, David writes that time has not flowed normally since his daughter was born, and one can understand why after having heard that story. But he also adds that time has been off kilter really for everyone since the pandemic arrived. I felt that. Have you felt that?
Yes, listen, I definitely have. And I've written before and spoken before about how drama in particular is one of the main mechanisms in which we can understand time. An interesting sort of mental fact is that human beings have very bad memories. We've got one of the worst memories of any species. We can't remember anything.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, totally. So a kind of corollary of that is we've also got very bad verification procedures. So, you know, when somebody says something, it takes a long time for us to find out whether they're telling us the truth or not. So when we're in complicated situations and we're trying to link cause and effect, it's very difficult for us. And I think narratives generally, and drama in particular, kind of present a sort of simplified model where we can kind of sort of understand the consequences of our actions. Mm. And I was thinking that when we are in very difficult emergency-like situations, then of course time, I mean, it is physically different. We know quantum physicists say, look, time isn't like a tabletop. It is what we perceive it, or at least our perceptions are very integral to what it is. And so when we are plunged into those emergency situations, and all plays focus on them really one way or another, then we learn something very integral about what's important, who we are, and the choices that we make. I was thinking, just as I was listening to both David and Kristen talking, that one of the oldest dramas is the Oresteia. It's the oldest full drama that we've got. It was written in, you know, 500 BCE by Aeschylus. And it's about a family that explodes, really, the house of Atreus. And if there is one sort of take home from that drama, it's that it is possible to make terrible mistakes. And therefore, the need to look ahead is paramount. And one of the problems with the economic language that Australia and many other Western countries seem to reach for first to explain something is that it encourages a kind of replacement theory of life where, oh, yes, you know, you've lost $500 million on Tuesday, but you can make it back on Wednesday. And you only have to follow the stock exchange every night to get the feeling, oh, well, you know, down on Monday, up on Friday. But of course, human life doesn't work like that. And it is quite possible to make a fateful choice and then only later to come to regret it. And now I'm going to say two things. One is just like a little general proposition, which is it feels to me like the pandemic is a dress rehearsal for climate change, really, which is a terrible thing to say because God knows the pandemic is consequential enough. But as David said, if we can't actually do the right thing, even in a situation where our lives are at stake and obviously in the short term, then how on earth are we going to come at a kind of larger collective challenge where the effects are more distal? The second thing was a little personal anecdote, which was that I did one of the first anti-Iraq war plays back in 2005. We'd been engaged then in the second Iraq war for a few years, and I did a play called Cruel and Tender, which is an adaptation of the Trachiniae, the ancient Greek play by Martin Crimp. And I had walkouts every night, and people hated me for doing that play. I can remember going into the auditorium and feeling the wall of hate that was coming at me because I was saying something that people thought was offensive or, I don't know, impertinent or whatever. And I just thought the other day, I wish I had the telephone numbers. I wish I could call them all up now and go, now that it's over,
yep,
and, you know, Iraq's a mess and we're pulling out of Afghanistan and all those thousands, if not millions of people have died, do you still think you made the right choice?
Look, I think there's something you said there too about the possibility of correcting past mistakes as well, the possibility of admitting that you are wrong. So much of the discourse today is, well, that's just how things are. And I know that Kristen wants to talk about that, and I will come to Kristen and get a response to her. But how this plays out in the play that you write about in the essay in the Griffith Review, a play called Lamb, which is about three siblings. They've reunited at their mother's funeral on the family farm. They've got to decide what to do with the farm. And of course, like I suppose people can almost predict this, they have to look back over their lives together and deal with all of the mess of the past. And there is a reversal in the play, a revelation, if you like, when time winds back. And, and you write, new understanding brings new choices about what could or should happen next. This is the door of the future swinging open. That's where the hope comes in. Is that an allegory? Was that intended as such? Are you commenting that in the midst of this terrible moment that we're all living through, that there is hope that we can look back and change our ways?
Oh, absolutely. Completely. Totally. Absolutely. 100%. That's not just a feature of Lamb. There are many plays, many, many plays that say that. They just say, look, stop, look back and go forward. And but only if you go back can you go forward, because life is full of mistakes. We make them all the time. And there's no way, even from this point onwards, that we're not going to make more of them in the future. So the capacity to learn from the mistakes becomes absolutely crucial. And to learn from it on every single level, politically, ethically, personally, emotionally. And with that capacity, then, you know, you're not the person given the fish, you're the person who's learned to fish. You can move forward and we can get through whatever comes next. Mm. But without it, it's a cold and unfriendly universe.
Yeah, there's so much of such great value that's being discussed here. And I think one of the most moving things about the story that David has told is that you're so humbled by the medical staff because they were in full possession of the human scale of what is going on in the lives of your children. Right? They're in full possession of that. And you said something, David, about how, you know, resourcing decisions made at some higher level of administration could well have been the difference in respect to the care that your baby was able to be given. And that's something that really strikes me in being concerned about what it means to experience the powers of government and how so many visionary and important policy initiatives can be undone through misplaced or thoughtless decisions about how they will be implemented. Mm. And I think that in terms of the grasping the human implications of things, something that I think we all have to learn so much from is the robo-debt crisis, insofar not just the fact that it happened at all, not just the fact that the legality of things was optional, which is a chronic problem in the Australian system at the moment, but the fact that no consideration was given to the experiences of the people on the receiving end of those debt notices. And I think what I have found most disturbing in how that drama has unfolded is the complete refusal of key government actors to accept the proposition that some people may well have taken their lives out of the acute stress that being in that situation caused them. It is like there's a numbness, there's a refusal to see the sort of end game human implications of some of these decisions. And although the hotel quarantine example, we can't put everything related to what went wrong there on governmental techniques, one of the things that I found so important about that moment, which I don't think we grasped. And I think, David, you were saying the same thing. If not now, when do we have these conversations? But in that moment, we were holding up a governmental practice to standards beyond itself. And that's what's so important, whether it be we're holding up practices to human standards about human needs, human implications, like what RoboDebt had, the effect it had on people, the extraordinary stress it caused, but we're holding them up to something other than themselves, because that's the problem. When you say, you said before, Paul, you know, this is just how things are. Well, yeah. No, it's a series of choices have led us to where things are. There are another series of choices that could be made, but that it's absolutely essential to critically rethink how we're doing things. And I think the Hey Utopia collection that we've all contributed to our essays to, there's a weariness to it, but there's also a real attention to the detail of where we're at, so that we can think about where we wish to be beyond this. And in my case, take seriously how what look like technical little decisions about how can have profound implications in what they bring about.
You say it cannot be that political and government officials at higher level are simply not as good or care less than they used to. And this may well be true, but if something larger is going on, could it be, for example, that they've simply figured out a way to more easily evade accountability for the mistakes under their watch? A, because they've figured out that the electorate expects less of them, and B, because they've managed to put into place a system whereby the public sector takes on less of the core functions of what government does. So that actually also puts them at arm's length from the mistakes that take place. I suppose what I'm asking is, could this actually be a conscious way of evading and avoiding responsibility?
I think it can be both. I think that the neoliberal project, insofar that it uses the apparatus of the state to institute a competitive market system and to have principles of competition that govern all aspects of life, I don't think it was necessarily brought into being to evade accountability. I think that it's a vision of how government should behave that is broader than that. However, very conveniently, it causes profound accountability problems at the same time. And the reason is because its logic runs against the logic of accountability that our systems are built around. In particular, it reconfigures the relationships that make accountability meaningful, not just relationships between institutions in our constitutional order, but relationships of accountability to us. So what we saw with the hotel quarantine example was nothing remarkable in the current state of Australian politics. This is how things are done. But what we saw was that these practices, something as mundane sounding as contracting out, turns all of the accountability demands on their head. They simply are unable to operate. It makes it impossible for the stories we tell ourselves about the system we exist in to actually operate in accordance with the stories that we're telling ourselves. And is this deliberate, or has it just become habitual? I honestly think we could have different conversations at different points throughout history. But what I do know is that where we're at is, whether you're in a zealous adherent to this particular way of doing government, or merely an inheritor of the particular structures that we've got, we have created patterns of thought and practice that replicate these arrangements. And that's what I saw with the witnesses to this inquiry. I saw competent and committed person, one after another, not conscious of the patterns of thought and practice they're engaged in and how it was reproducing something that was so vastly at odds with what we expected from government. And they did it innocently. And this is back to the sort of theatrical point we said earlier. There was a innocence about the way in which they spoke of what went on in those crucial days. There was, I mean, I don't want to say cluelessness, but there was something detached about an understanding that the way they were behaving as governmental actors was against the demands of the very system that gives them authority to act.
Look, I mean, I suppose if we are to look at something positive that came from your story, David, it is, well, that your partner and your daughter are on the mend, but also such was the level of medical intervention required for your daughter after she was born that you calculated that you are well on the way to $500,000 in costs as a result of the neonatal intensive care, but of course you won't be receiving a bill for this because we have a free universal public hospital system. It has survived the march of neoliberalism, this wonderful thing that we have in Australia. Begs the question, is this utopia, our universal free healthcare system in Australia, Medicare?
On a certain level, yes, absolutely. And that was a thought that came through my mind as I wrote, that it was incredible that we received such wonderful care for Charlotte and that brought her through such a difficult situation. But as the time has passed since we've left the hospital and as Charlotte's care has become less acute, and also as I've thought more about the pandemic, there are these troubling pressure points within our medical system where the distinction between public and private has been tested since the original founding of the system. So I think a comprehensive answer to your question is a bit more partial or a bit more vague than an emphatic yes, which is what I would have given you while we were in the hospital. The acute care was amazing. And I'm sure almost all people who go through the hospital system think the same thing. Politically, thinking at these systemic levels, England has had the same sort of dynamics. The NHS is a much loved part of the social and political landscape, despite it being chipped away at over the years. And yet the march of the impact of neoliberal policies or privatization, marketization has felt its effects in other parts of society there as it has in Australia. So I don't think the fact that parts of the system are operating well should allow us to be complacent about the potential for them to not work as well in future. And also, even now, thinking about our pandemic response at the points when the medical system has been under pressure, there has been a need raised to close private hospitals, to have those practitioners move across to treating public patients, to open the doors for those specialists to be used in the public system. And so that suggests that there's a latency in the system on the private side, that people who are waiting months or years, even outside of pandemic times, for an operation or for care that is critical in their lives, even if it's not at the top of a critical list for the public system. If that latency is there on the private side, then should we not be using it to treat those people if we believe that public healthcare is a universal right?
Julian, what shape do you think the arts and culture sector will be in once lockdown ends and gradually performances recommence and theatres open? This is a sector where the artists themselves have been bruised, as you say, have felt profoundly rejected and disregarded. What does the road back look like, do you think?
Yeah, it's not quick. And some things you don't get over. You'll always find some artists who've done okay. There are always winners in every situation. But I think, generally speaking, it is what poker players would call a tell. Something has been communicated about the lack of a place for arts and culture within Australia. And it's raised this question of like, well, if you could leave that out, what is actually in place? What is there centrally? I think there is one job that arts and culture as a broadly will have to do as we go into living with COVID, which is artists will have to decide what all of this means. You know, so politicians keep the wheels turning around and people do whatever they do. But at some point, somebody will have to write, open inverted commas, the COVID play, close inverted commas. And I was thinking about how difficult that is, because it is a collective experience, of course, but we have all gone through it individually.
And that's where we'll have to leave our discussion. I was talking with Professor Kristen Rundle, David Threlfall, and Professor Julian Mayrick. They're all contributors to the Griffith Review edition, Hey Utopia. That discussion was meant to take place at the Melbourne Writers Festival, but instead occurred online via Zoom. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Until next time, bye for now.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.